taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene. Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning, I'm Tina Janoukas. Welcome to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today on the show, I have Peter Malapanis. She has been active in the Melbourne poetry scene, reading at venues. Her work has been published in various anthologies. Her chapbook, Unspeakable, is published by Owl Publishing. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you, Tina. Happy to be here.
Tell us about the title of your chapbook, Unspeakable. It's an intriguing title for a collection of poems.
The title comes from the Greek concept that when you get cancer, you don't talk about it. Even when people talk about other people having cancer or being diagnosed with it, they don't say that. They say they have that disease that has no name, the disease that we don't talk about. And that's what I was thinking about when I was pulling these poems together. It was very difficult to tell my family, my parents, my mum, that I had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and it sprung from that.
Because, of course, a lot of the poems in the chapbook do deal with your cancer diagnosis. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
Correct. Once I started on that trajectory of what we don't talk about easily in a Greek family, I ended up in a few other places as well.
Could you read the opening poem, After the Dance?
I certainly can. After the Dance. Cancer is not a journey. It is an assault against body, mind, spirit. An assault that fundamentally challenges both certainty and self. An assault that shines a light on 3 a.m., illuminating both outstretched arms and stiffly turned backs. An assault that carves time out of stunned silence for laughter as well as tears, for strength and stumbling, for wise words and thoughtless quips. An assailant that has my number on speed dial. I have not kicked anyone's butt. I'm not a survivor. I'm not a warrior. At best, an unwilling participant in a dance I do not know the steps to. I was tripped and dragged, dazed to the gallows, sheer luck and a handful of statistics stumbled by my side, escorting me to the edge of the abyss. As it turned out, instead of the certainty of the noose, I was granted a lifetime of second guessing, a new relationship with fear and a humble gratitude for both.
I find that a defiant poem. It's refusing the idea of cancer as a journey. What do you think?
I think that it refuses the idea of cancer as a journey, but also it refuses a lot of the other things that come with that. So a lot of the concepts of you're a survivor or be positive or any sort of judgment about how you interact with cancer. I found it really interesting at the start that everybody had an opinion about how I was being, about what road I was going to go on, what decisions I was going to make, and even how lucky I was. At different steps of my diagnosis, there was different tests, different results, and then people would go, oh, wow, that's amazing, you know, you're so lucky. And I'm like, let me help you out with that. Luck has got nothing to do with it, A, but B, what do you mean by that? Getting a diagnosis that may or may not be stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four, it comes with its own host of fallout, if you like, that is not really part of our everyday discourse about it.
Why did you feel a need to share?
Because I don't think I'm that unique. And I think that if I experience something, someone else has also experienced it. And if I haven't read about it, that means that someone's experienced it and they're not talked about it. And so I think we should be talking about that. Put a name to the unspeakable, say it out loud, not take the fear away, but make it not as unknown.
I suppose that invites all sorts of comments from people then, doesn't it?
It certainly does, but the comments were there to start with. So at least these comments are in an environment that I've set up the parameters for, and they're also invited in a sense that I've started a dialogue, as opposed to I'm trying to get my head around the most shocking thing that's happened to me.
How did you come to write the poem?
I write to process as a rule. That's a lot of my experiences, a lot of things that I've dealt with in my life. In order to better understand myself and the situation that I find myself in, I find that writing helps to distill my thoughts, helps to clarify my feelings. And so in the middle of this particular experience, there was very little sleep. I may have been exhausted throughout it, but the various drugs they have you on means that your heart's racing at night and all sorts of things like that. So I found that I could, if I had a job to do, which was to write this out, to get it out of my system, to try to understand it, I had a lot of time to do it in. So I just literally opened up a notebook and kept pouring myself into it.
So were the poems in Unspeakable written as a way of dealing with the diagnosis?
Without question, but not limited to just the diagnosis, also dealing with people's reactions to the diagnosis, with my own unexpected, often, responses to things. I remember literally standing in front of the mirror and saying almost like a mantra, you have curly hair, you have hazel eyes, you have breast cancer, just three things about you. Not special, not anything. You just are.
Could you read No One Tells You?
No one tells you. No one tells you how to tell your kids. What words to use when you have yet to formulate words, words you can swallow, words you have not had time to digest. They don't tell you how to compose your face, hide the fear in your eyes, or steady your quivering voice. They don't tell you how to keep him steady when your world won't stop moving. How to arm him with the confidence to steady his hands, the clarity to accompany you into the darkness without losing his own sense of direction, or the strength to stay steady for his sister. His sister, young enough to want to believe in happy endings, to be convinced by upbeat tones and positive spins, to allow herself plans for a tomorrow without allowing herself the chance that you might not be there. His sister, just old enough to know to hide her tears, her shattered heart, keep her nightmares far from you, and in whispered tones share, I'm okay, with well-meaning friends. They don't tell you how to sit on the other side of a locked bathroom door, jaw clenched, eyes full, unable to make a sound, listening to them each convince the other today was a better day.
Could you tell us about the fury of a mother and the vulnerability of children when the mother is facing a cancer diagnosis?
I can certainly tell you my experience of that, which was horrendous and possibly one of the hardest things that I had to survive. First of all, just the telling to the children, and telling it in such a way that whatever fears or horror you might be feeling, it's tucked away somewhere behind you and you're just giving them the facts and looking them in the eye while you're doing it so that everyone's confident that where it's going to be good. And then not being present enough throughout that whole period to maintain the facade, I guess. So watching them support each other, there's 8 years difference between my son and my daughter, and he was integral in giving me injections and like just managing some sort of bigger stuff that she wasn't able to be part of, or nor would I have wanted her ever to be part of. But his strength and confidence in that was something that I had to feed, and then sit and watch him try to support her through that. That was the hardest part of all of this.
And putting all of that into the poem?
I was impressed that I could read that actually without my voice breaking. So very hard, but very necessary. That's another thing I don't think that we talk about. You know, we have these awful diseases, awful diagnoses and everything that comes with that. And as a mother, you have to keep your children safe. You have to protect them from whatever it is that you might be feeling. But at the same time, they can't help but see what's happening in their own home. So that struggle between you want to be authentic or you don't know how to not be authentic with what's going on with you, and at the same time, of course it's going to be fine. Of course it's going to be fine.
And yet the poet must speak.
Yet the feelings must be articulated somehow. And even the digging deeper into what is it about that that was so horrifying for me was something that I felt compelled to do.
How about we hear from Curly to Crew Cut?
Certainly. And as I sit before you today, I'm definitely back to Curly again, but there was many years in between when Crew Cut was the go. I started off with the best of intentions, the noblest of ideas, the desire to wrest some control from an otherwise uncontrollable situation. I articulated the plan, calling it into existence. I want to shave my head before chemo starts. I don't want my hair to fall out. I do not want my hair to fall out. All over the house, all over my pillow, my clothes. No, I want to shave my head before chemo starts. I want to look strong before I look sick. With that thought, I followed my son into the bathroom, and all semblance of strength I thought I had mustered quietly left the room. Before he picked up any tools, he noted the panic barely contained by my set jaw. He cradled my head so tenderly, I loved him all the more for it. His steady grip, unwavering determination to get it right, helped me focus my frantic eyes. And as a smaller, more distilled version of me emerged from under borrowed shears, it was his quiet smile of achievement that helped me face my fear in the mirror and declare, I can rock this.
It seems to me that what that poem is saying is that taking control of a cancer diagnosis was incredibly empowering for you. Would that be an assumption?
That would be an absolute truth, well beyond an assumption. All of it is so uncontrollable and made worse somehow by the various physicians and dietitians that you get involved with who say things like, oh, you know, you really must change your diet and eat this and the other thing and that will help. And I'm listening to everything they're telling me and it's everything I've eaten my whole life. So, no, that's not it. They sort of drip feed you information as well about what the next treatment's going to be or what the next procedure's going to be, primarily, I think, because your brain can't hold everything if you get it all at once. So that feeling of not being in control of these things as they unfold, it doesn't go away. It's not like you're not in control at the beginning and then suddenly you get control. You have no control over the whole process. Any small thing that I could do to even pretend to have control was very, very empowering. And that was a very physical, visible thing that I could do. And it helped. It helped. I stood taller, I squared my shoulders, and it was a whole other version of me. No fluff, no curl, nothing to hide behind. Here I am.
Was writing this particular poem a part of that control taking?
Writing this poem was actually more about trying to immortalise a moment that I never thought I would experience. In that exchange between me and my son, the roles were completely reversed. I was so vulnerable and so scared and wanting not to be, and he wanted to prove that he could do this right for his mum. And that was something so unfamiliar to me that I was moved and motivated and compelled to try to document it in a way that I could look back on later and go, I remember that. And I have not read that poem for a really long time, and I remember that.
So it brought you closer to your children.
Oh, my God, yes, absolutely it did. And also it made me more confident that they'd be okay, because nobody knows how that's going to turn out. And I remember thinking, okay, well, if the worst happens, my tribe have stepped up. I know that they're not going to be alone, and they've stepped up for each other, and that's going to be okay.
Are you a 3CR subscriber?
We really need our listeners to subscribe to the station. It helps us remain financially independent and is an important part of our community governance.
It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Become a 3CR subscriber today.
3CR, Radical Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Tina Janoukas. You're listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today I'm speaking with Peter Malapanis about her chapbook, Unspeakable. I find kintsugi, which is the traditional Japanese art of repairing broken pottery, the most metaphorical of the poems in Unspeakable, your chapbook collection. Could you read it?
Kintsugi. I nurse an ache so deep inside I can almost separate it from myself. I refuse to talk to it and shower every morning with precise determination to eliminate it from my bones. Confronted by my now unfamiliar flesh, I struggle to touch myself, struggle to feel thick skin, puckered scars, swollen nodes, cracks in an exterior I used to know. I insist on daily ritual ablutions to force my hand, creams and lotions designed to regenerate, integrate, restore. With tentative fingers, I push upon fresh memories, nerves that have failed to heal lend a numbness to my skin and a corpse-like pallor to my nipple, which in turn fascinates and terrifies. In time, I become mesmerized by these cracks, glaring remnants that define the last year, unpalatable leftovers impossible to ignore. With care, I construct a different future and cast myself as kintsugi, a collection of broken pieces incorporated into the whole, creating a new aesthetic of the now restored woman, making it more than part of my history, a lifeline to the very core of me, making me stronger, more broken, yet more able to face man and machine, designed in turn to both hurt and heal.
In all the swirl of a cancer diagnosis, telling your children, the family, your own treatment, how do you approach the self as an aesthetic object?
That was, interestingly enough, harder than I originally thought. So initially, when they said, we found this mass and it's in your left breast, I was like, cut it all off, cut everything off, get rid of it. And the surgeon at the time said, I know you feel this, but trust me, let me do my job. I'll get the bits that we need and you will thank me for this later. I trusted, but I didn't quite believe her. In the time that followed that, my coming to terms and refamiliarizing myself with my body in a way that was loving and was gentle and kind and not angry, not, you know, the bad boob, the good boob, like I went through that whole period. So not judging it, just this is the new me, this is what it looks like. And then finally drawing strength from this is new, this is me, this is better. This is better because it's been through so much. This is better because it's still standing here. So it looks different. It feels different, like from the outside it feels different, but also from the inside it feels different. And aesthetically, it's different. I know myself, I knew myself, and I had to learn myself in a whole other way.
Why did you go to the Japanese idea of the kintsugi?
I had some really interesting scars. 1 year after the breast cancer, they also found a melanoma on that same breast. So more surgery had to be done in an already damaged space. And the scarring was really interesting. So I spent a lot of time just running my fingers over those seams, and it was an image that instantly materialised for me. Someone had brought me back some pottery once that had been with that beautiful gold inlay, had been restructured after it had been shattered, and the puckering, the effect of all these surgeries reminded me so much like that. It wasn't hard to then, from there, go, all these broken pieces could be less than separately, but together they are definitely more than.
Because the idea of kintsugi is that you put together a broken piece of pottery, but not the idea of perfection. You don't put it back perfectly. So I'm interested in how that feeds into the whole experience.
Yes, you know, you don't put it back perfectly, and your body is no longer perfect. Nothing about you is perfect anymore, and only in so much as, I mean, I guess when no one is perfect to start with, but your perfect self, who you knew and who you grew into, that's perfect for you. And then that is shattered in so many ways. So not only is your mind shattered in terms of, I didn't even know that I could survive this, I didn't even know how I would stand in front of somebody, have them say this to me, and still be standing at the end of that sentence, but physically, the body that you grew into, the body that nurtured children, so the body that you got to know under so many different guises, is now a whole other animal. And that was imperfect and yet somehow perfectly me again.
Was writing the poem Kintsugi a way of reclaiming some of that self?
I think writing it fits in the same category as the previous poem that we spoke about, trying to get some control over an uncontrollable situation. What they do to your body, what is done to it, is out of control. They ask you to sign papers and they ask you to agree and they ask you, do you want to go ahead with this? And you're the least qualified person in the room. So you say yes to everything and you walk in vaguely confidently that you've made the right decision, but only because there are people in white coats next to you telling you that that's the case. How do you get control in that situation? You reclaim your body, you reclaim it and you love it again. And that was empowering also.
So I suppose a question that's going through my mind is writing these poems a way of empowering the self?
Without doubt, Tina, without doubt. There is so much that you give up when you enter the medical system in such a huge way that reclaiming yourself becomes a side project that begins to define you. And this was very much the product of that.
The chapbook, of course, doesn't simply chart a journey with cancer. It touches on other themes. Could you read Heaven Help Us if we name them?
Of course. This one is so pertinent still, and sadly so. Heaven help us if we name them. Then they also came by boat, fleeing post-war poverty, political persecution, bleak futures and bloody pasts. They bundled their few possessions into the smallest of bags, and with hope in their hearts, they pushed their fear, their desperation, their loneliness into the depths of their empty pockets to come to this new land. They carried their food, their language, their culture, clutched tightly to their chest, their poetry, their theatre, their songs, they tucked under their tongues. Their white skin and strong backs did not frighten you much. They changed their names so you would not choke on unfamiliar sounds, bowed their heads so you could look at them without hating them, without blaming them, and the decades passed. Now different boats are coming, different faces with no names, a vast ocean of faces we do not see, and as long as we don't name them, we don't have to think of them, each and every one of them, as men, as women, as children. We don't have to smell their fear, see their desperation, feel their hopelessness. We don't have to weep for their dreams, acknowledge the gods they hold sacred, hear the stories they have swallowed. As long as we don't name them, there are no nods to their rights, no space for their voice, no room for their lives.
What motivates that poem?
It actually started from a comment that an aunt of mine made about some new migrants that had come into the area and they were taking their jobs. And I thought, wow, are we still saying that sentence? And that made me think about them when they first came, and that was what was talked about them. And then I thought how easily and how quickly we become the people that perpetuate that narrative when we get one step above the new migrant sort of label. And sadly, you know, we're still here.
Could you read your older brother?
Yes, it's an interesting one. People don't often land on that. Your older brother. The Holden Kingswood is a really heavy car. And mid-July with a flat battery, it is heavier still. A hulk of metal, gears disengaged, power drained, motionless. Your mood is dark and bleak as the morning you are trying to greet. I lock my knees, arms extended, shift my centre of gravity, embrace myself. Your shirt strains against your shoulders, half in and half out of the driver's door. I watch you try to steer one-handed, calculating the exact moment to jump behind the wheel. The boot of the car is so cold, it hurts my hands. I tug on shrunken sleeves in a futile attempt to put a layer between my warm skin and the icy metal. I call upon the strength of my neck, the power of my chest, my elbows and palms, and focus on keeping my rounded belly as far from the steel as I can. You don't look behind you as you grunt orders, and on your command I put my whole weight forward, holding my breath, pushing as hard as I can, pleading for the car to move. By the time the wheels start turning, gripping the ground with intent, by the time the car has moved from the curb, by the time I have caught my breath enough to call out to you, my face is glistening with sweat, my arms are trembling, and the heat spreading between my legs has shrunk my tomorrow to nothing.
What I find interesting about this poem and about many of the poems in the collection is that it seems to be asking an underlying question, which is, what does it mean to give in relationships?
What does it mean to give everything till there is nothing left of you in relationships in that particular instance? That was a story that my mother told me about her experience. So she had a miscarriage before I was born, and I was the eldest of three kids. And that's how it happened. She gave so much of herself. She gave her child to a moment in time, a moment that my father gave no thought to, couldn't see beyond his own need to get things moving. And she didn't have the sense of self to protect herself from that. All she knew was how to give everything of herself, to sacrifice for, to him, to her children, to ultimately her whole life. It was a very hard poem for her, for me to write, because it was a very hard story for her to tell. And then she never spoke of it again. I tried to bring up the conversation, and she never spoke of it again. And I thought, I'm going to write it down, because if I don't hear this again, I'm going to not be able to visit it again. And I think it deserves documenting.
When I read it, I found it a puzzling poem. And in a way, you've answered the puzzle. Why did you write it in the first person?
Because it was her story, not mine. And she told it, she started the story with, you know, you've got an older brother. And I'm like, start that again, please. And that's how it started. So she was telling me about my older brother. So that was the only voice I could write it in.
Could you read In Your Arms Again?
My father actually passed away before I was diagnosed with breast cancer. So this one was written prior to the others. I didn't realise how much it fit into it until I was coming to pull these together. In Your Arms Again. In the temperature-controlled, contrived evening, you lay still in your bed, propped into someone's version of comfort, unable to move yourself. Beyond caring, you shift in and out of sleep. The blinking monitor keeps vigil above your head silently. Your hands, calloused and broad, the hands of a working man, lay on top of the sheet, twitching unconsciously, looking for something. With an almost involuntary burst of energy, your left hand finds mine, till now fluttering uselessly around you, straightening sheets, stroking cheeks, filling the silence with movement. Suddenly immobilized, your sudden surge of strength crushes my fingers. Silver rings bite cruelly into my flesh. Imprisoned thus, sweat-soaked and numb, I am once more in your arms.
What happens to intimate relationships in the face of illness?
They get distilled into the very essence of themselves. I think that was the biggest lesson that I got from all of this. I felt like I became the purest sense of myself, but my relationships also were distilled into the core of what they were. So the fluff, I use that word a lot, not fluff, the extraneous fuzz around that can confuse, unnecessary, just fades away. And what's left with actually what's important in this relationship, a clarity that I wish you could get a different way.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Tina.
I'm Tina Janoukas. You've been listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today I've been speaking with Peter Malapanis about her chapbook, Unspeakable, published by Owl Publishing. Spoken Word broadcasts every Thursday at 9 a.m. on 855 AM, or you can download the podcast. Unspeakable is available from Owl Publishing. Thank you for listening.